We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. In the corner of Cathedral Square, you might notice a plaque. It describes an incident in March of 1854 in which runaway slave Joshua Glover was freed from the jail in then Courthouse Square by a group of abolitionist Milwaukeeans. But George Gonis thinks a single plaque can't fully describe what he calls one of the most significant historical moments for black-white relations in Milwaukee. Gonis is the board president of the Joshua Glover Cathedral Square Project, which wants to create a monument to Glover's story and its national impact. Gonis tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce that the popular sentiment in Wisconsin at the time set the stage for the incident to occur.
Wisconsin was actually a bastion of abolitionist and anti-slavery thought. There was an interesting reason for that. Of course, at that time, early Wisconsin was settled a lot by people from upstate New York and New England, often people who were Quakers, who were Unitarians or Universalists, and various other religions that had strong abolitionist sentiments. Those are the individuals who in great part settled Wisconsin in the 1830s and 40s. So that kind of brought that abolitionist sentiment here. So even by the 1840s, there was an awareness by people who were enslaved, who were seeking their freedom, that Wisconsin was a good place to find yourself. And there were, so they were aware of the sentiment that existed here. And by the way, I should interject that were there people in Wisconsin in the 1840s and 50s who were bigoted? Yes. Were there people who in Wisconsin at that time who were pro-slavery? Yes. But fortunately, luckily, they were outnumbered by the people who felt the other way. And so the Underground Railroad had already established itself here by the 1840s. The first known passenger, one of the first known passengers, a name that a lot of people will know, is Carolyn Quarles, who escaped from the St. Louis area, found her way to Milwaukee in the early 1840s, before, by the way, Harriet Tubman. That said, by the time we get to the 1850s, when the Joshua Glover story is beginning to emerge, the Underground Railroad had been operating here, and in addition to the sentiment, think of where we are here in Wisconsin. We're on the Great Lakes. We're on Lake Michigan. Commerce is big, and steamers and schooners are all over the lakes, even in the 1840s and 50s. And so those steamers and schooners can take you to freedom in Canada. So Wisconsin, and Milwaukee in particular, as well as Racine, Kenosha, they were the last American stops, the terminus, if you will, before going to Canada, the last stop before Canada. So that made us very important.
And so then, as you mentioned, one of those people seeking their freedom was Joshua Glover. Who exactly was he and what happened to him here?
Joshua Glover, who is enslaved on a farm in the St. Louis area by a man named Benamy Garland, Glover escapes in 1852, and he makes his way to Racine and arrives in Racine in 1852 and gets a job in a sawmill. And over a fairly short time, he becomes a very well-liked, very well-respected member of the community. But in 1850, a little before this, the Fugitive Slave Act was passed. And what it said was that even when a person escapes slavery and they go to a free state, that you are obligated, every citizen is obligated to return that person to slavery, and that they gave great license to the slave owner and slave catchers. There still had to be a legal process. Technically, you had to produce them in court in that state, the free state perhaps where you captured them, before you brought them back to slavery. But federal marshals and slave owners and slave catchers were given great license to just go into any free state and capture people who had been slaves and drag them back into slavery. That didn't set well with the abolitionists and anti-slave people in Wisconsin. Glover's ex-master, Benamy Garland, with the federal law in hand, upheld by the United States Supreme Court, Benamy Garland comes to Racine essentially late one Friday evening and with federal marshals goes to the cabin where Glover or shack where Glover lives and bursts in and there's a scuffle and federal marshals are there with handcuffs and they beat Glover up pretty severely, and they throw him in the back of the wagon, and they go in the middle of the night. They figure, well, if we stop in Racine, where they are, the jail is so small and rickety, and the abolitionist sentiment is so high, they could break him out. And since we have to go to Milwaukee, which was the federal seat, so to speak, anyway, let's just go back to Milwaukee in the dead of night. They got lost on the way, delayed the trip, got there late. That gave enough time for the abolitionists in Racine to telegraph the abolitionists in Milwaukee as to what happened.
And so then once they arrived in Milwaukee, then what happened?
They put him in jail on what is today Cathedral Square. It was called Courthouse Square at the time. That's where the courthouse was. So that's where local government occurred, and that's where federal, any acts associated with the federal government occurred. That was the only governmental building of any kind in Milwaukee in 1854. It was the building in Milwaukee, the only civic building in Milwaukee at the time. And the jail is essentially adjacent to the courthouse on Cathedral Square. And Glover's put there very early in that Saturday morning. Within a few hours, because of the telegraphing going back and forth, 5,000 people gather in Cathedral Square.
And that also had to do with the abolitionist newspaper published by Sherman Booth.
Correct.
He was one of the ones who was rallying these people to what's now Cathedral Square.
Correct. There was when the abolitionist editor in Racine telegraphed Sherman Booth, because they knew one another. In the meantime, there's a rally that Saturday morning in Racine. So very early that Saturday morning, they passed several resolutions. One of them, and it's a terrific quote, it's inspiring to hear, quote, "Adopting as our motto the golden rule, we as citizens of Wisconsin do hereby declare the slave-catching law of 1850 disgraceful and also repealed," which I think is a great quote from that resolution. And so then a group of 100 men from Racine boarded a boat in Racine and headed for Milwaukee Saturday morning. They arrived around noon, and by the time they got there, Sherman Booth, whom you mentioned a moment ago, who had been alerted by the Racine abolitionist editor, had stirred up the people in Milwaukee. He rode, in fact, Paul Revere-like, on horse around the city, wow, around what we know was the downtown area, saying, you know, freemen to the rescue. If you don't want to be a slave or a slave catcher, come to Cathedral Square. And, of course, in a very short time, 5,000 people gathered. That's about 15% of the entire Milwaukee population at the time, gathered in just a moment's notice. Part of that group, by the way, it was not just Sherman Booth on horseback gathering people, but Milwaukee had a small but very vocal and active African-American population in the 1850s. And there was indeed what was called at the time the Committee of Colored Abolitionists. They were also very involved in gathering people at that square, and they were very present at the square. But it was still obviously, in terms of demographics and population, mostly a white grouping in Cathedral Square that morning. And Judge Carl Ashley, who's both a judge here in Milwaukee and a member of our board and a historian as well, and very much a judicial historian at this moment, talks about the fact that, you know, if you're Joshua Glover, think about it. You look out your cell window in this, and you're captured by your slave owner, and you're going to be taken back into slavery. And you see this crowd, and for a moment, you wonder what's happening. And Judge Ashley said, "I know of many moments in history where this scene for a black person is reenacted time and time again. You're in jail, an unruly crowd is gathering, and you think you're going to lose your life. You think you're going to be hanged, murdered. But this was a group of people there to free and rescue Joshua Glover, not to kill him or murder him."
And so they battered down the door and spirited him away, so to say.
They demand the keys, and they refused the keys. There were piles of construction materials everywhere, many piles of large, heavy beams. And so this young man who had just arrived from Cornwall in England, in response to their request for the key being refused, says, "Here's a good enough key," and he points to this beam, and a bunch of big burly guys go across the street, get this beam, go back to the jail, which is kind of on the cathedral side of the street, the door was, if you can think of where the cathedral is today, and knock the door down, free Joshua Glover. He's lifted on people's shoulders, there's shouts of hallelujah, he's put in a wagon, and Glover begins an Underground Railroad journey entirely in Wisconsin, at Underground Railroad stops and stations in Wisconsin for about the next approximately 40 days. And he finally, oddly enough, is smuggled back into Racine, and his last stop is the Dutton Warehouse. A.P. Dutton was a big shipping magnate in Racine and an abolitionist. And, in fact, more than 100 people we know were hidden in the Dutton Warehouse, so not just Glover. And he makes his way to Canada. And through the recent research by Ruby West Jackson and Walter McDonald, the story used to end there. Now we know that he spent the last 34 years of his life in Canada, where he lived, who he worked for, and the history is really becoming complete.
George Gonis is the board president of the Joshua Glover Cathedral Square Project. After a short break, we'll return for more of our interview with him. We'll learn how the freeing of Joshua Glover impacted the nation and how Wisconsin renounced federal law. I'm Bonnie North. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. Welcome back to Lake Effect. We continue now with more of our interview with George Gonis. Before the break, he told us the story of Joshua Glover, a runaway slave who was freed from Milwaukee's courthouse jail by a mob of abolitionists. Gonis is the board president of the Joshua Glover Cathedral Square Project. He explains to Lake Effect's Stephanie Lecce how the freeing of Joshua Glover reverberated across the country.
Glover's rescue, which made national headlines at the time, and national headlines for years based on how Wisconsin responded, because they were told by the federal government, you can't do that. You've got to return that person to slavery. And the Wisconsin Supreme Court said no. They declared the Fugitive Slave Act wicked, was a word by one of the justices, and unconstitutional, and they refused to enforce it. And to this day, there is no state that declared the Fugitive Slave Law unconstitutional except Wisconsin. This is the only place where this happened, instantly turning Cathedral Square into nationally hallowed ground. Glover's rescue leads, just a few weeks later, to the founding of the Anti-Slavery Republican Party in Wisconsin. There is a connection between the two. It wasn't the only thing that caused the formation, but it was an enormously important part of the Republican Party, forming the party that elected Lincoln. And I'll just add that the Republican Party in Wisconsin was known for the next several years as the most radical anti-slavery wing in the Republican Party. There were degrees of anti-slavery sentiment within the Republican Party, but if you wanted to find the radicals in the entire country who were members of the Republican Party, you would come to Wisconsin. And in fact, Wisconsin Republicans were heavily in favor of the franchise, the vote being extended to African-American people. And that didn't describe a lot of abolitionists.
Did this incident have national reverberations? Obviously, it was nationally known, but did it have an impact elsewhere in the country?
Oh, absolutely. When I talk about it making national headlines, Horace Greeley, famous abolitionist and New York editor, in his New York Tribune, had the headline trumpeting glorious Wisconsin. And we got telegrams from all of the famous abolitionists in America at the time. Wendell Phillips, Charles Sumner were sent here. The very name of Wisconsin just irritated pro-slavery forces to no end. James Buchanan, who was the president at the time, no friend of the anti-slavery forces, really was bothered by Wisconsin's action. So we affected the president of the United States, the national press, and this went on. It became a cause for years. And the next day, to me, I think a perfect picture, which kind of sums up something that we still need to live up to today, is the next day after Glover's rescue, so Sunday morning, Henry Clark, who owned the Pioneer Hair Salon, and he was one of the leading members of the Committee of Colored Abolitionists, in his barbershop, essentially, his hair salon, there was a very important meeting of Sherman Booth and several white abolitionists and several African-American abolitionists. So think of this scene. You have an African-American-owned business, and you have black abolitionists and white abolitionists all in the same room working together, asking themselves, okay, now what do we do next? And is Glover safe? And what should we do with the government response? And what do we do after this? And so on. And it's a really, I think, a spectacular scene in that barbershop the next morning to see people of all races, of these two races, working together. And I think that set a high bar. All of these things, both what Racinians and Milwaukeeans did that on that particular weekend in 1854, and then the subsequent response by Wisconsin over the months and then in years throughout the 1850s to uphold, to keep refusing. When the federal Supreme Court came and said, you have to do this, the Wisconsin Supreme Court again refused. You're supposed to file the federal Supreme Court decision. A state Supreme Court is supposed to file this federal Supreme Court's order. To this day, in 2009, the Wisconsin Supreme Court refuses to file that federal order. And they're very proud of that to this very day. That's important stuff. And we need to rise to that level today.
Well, I was just going to ask you that you talk about the high bar that was set by Wisconsinites and Milwaukeeans. Has Wisconsin and Milwaukee lived up to this history, or is this a reputation of the past in terms of the way that blacks and whites interact here?
I think one thing that points to the fact that we have fallen below that bar is that so much of this history has been forgotten, that we shook up the world, that we made national headlines for years, that we caught the attention of Buchanan and Lincoln and people and Stephen Douglas. You know, people on both sides of the issue were either pleased by it or bothered by it. And it's as if it never happened. Kids don't know about it. Wisconsinites don't know this history. It's stunning that they don't know it, which points to the fact that I think we have fallen below the bar. There was a Wisconsin historian, a fairly well-known one in 1900, who wrote in 1900, and I'm paraphrasing a bit, perhaps there will be a day after men's prejudices have died that we can erect a memorial telling the story of this in Cathedral Square. Now, that was in 1900. Quote, when men's prejudices have died, it's now 109 years later, and there's nothing that fully tells the national impact of this story in that square.
Right. There's a plaque in Cathedral Square honoring what happened, but you're working to have a full monument erected there that will really fully explain the whole story.
I'm glad that the plaque, which is a State Historical Society plaque, is there at all. It's better than, of course, nothing. But some of the things we've talked about today doesn't mention the fact that, oh, by the way, you know, Wisconsin is the only state that did this. This is one of the most historic moments in race relations history in the United States. There were national reverberations for years after it happened. That's not in there. And to me, that's tantamount to opening Ford's Theater to the public, but not mentioning that Lincoln was shot there. This is a major thing you're leaving out. So the plaque, again, not to knock it, I'm glad that it's there, but it needs so much more. Our nonprofit board and organization came together because we realized that given the fact that we worry about race relations and racial reconciliation for the decades yet to come, that this was a way to not only tell history, but to affect the future and make sure we rise to that level that was set for us when we first became a city and first became a state. And that we needed something in that square that was commensurate with the national significance of the history. Now, through the efforts of our organization, Cathedral Square has been declared by the National Park Service Network to Freedom Program as one of the key cornerstone underground railroad sites in the entire United States. But it's a very prestigious designation. It's not easy to get, but this is a very significant site. And I know that the National Park Service is anxious for us to do even more based on receiving that designation.
Well, what do you think that it means that your organization has kind of faced so many challenges and even at times reluctance toward developing this monument in Cathedral Square?
I think we have a lot of support in spirit, if you will. But there are the realities of lots of hands being out and lots of worthy causes and organizations being out there. We've been at this for a few years now, around 4 years or so, and we've reconfigured our approach initially because so many things do indeed have national and international design competitions, and this was such an important piece of history. We knew that people from around the country would be interested, but there seemed to be a reluctance on giving any money to a competition, and we understood that. So we did kind of shift gears in how we were doing this about 9 months ago or so, and we brought in, of course, HGA, which is an architectural firm here in town, and their lead designer has come up with the terrific design, inspired in great part by how the square looked during its most important period in history. The reason the Glover event happened in 1854 is that Cathedral Square was a gathering place for thousands of people. To honor that history, it needs to remain a gathering space so people can rest assured that anything that tells the Glover story will still maintain Cathedral Square as a place for jazz in the park, Bastille days, the farmer's market, and on and on and on. It will still be that Milwaukee's living room, that gathering place. But we also knew that to tell the Glover story, we needed someone really significant who got it. Preston Jackson, who is an internationally renowned artist who happens to be African-American, is also the director of the sculpture department at the Art Institute of Chicago. It's a huge feather in our cap. We just found out recently that he said, I want to do this. If you raise the money for this, I'm there. I'm doing this because this is one of the most important commissions I'll be doing ever. So that's a huge deal that someone of Preston Jackson's caliber wants to help us tell this story. And so we'll be presenting a design for approval as soon as we can, as we're still in the fundraising process, of course. And we're working with the county. Milwaukee Cathedral Square is a county park. And we're anxious to, again, tell this story in a manner that it deserves, again, to inspire people in the future to let's try to replicate the level of how people of different races worked together in 1854 and when there was such hope and such dynamism. Let's live up to that legacy because we need to do that, and that will affect yet unborn generations of Milwaukeeans to have in our living room, Milwaukee's living room, to be reminded every day this is what we're supposed to do as human beings.
Well, George Gonis, thank you so much for coming in and telling us about the efforts to get this monument built to Joshua Glover and about his story.
Thank you.
George Gonis is the board president of the Joshua Glover Cathedral Square Project. He spoke with Lake Effect's Stephanie Lecce. We'll take a short break now. When we come back, the story of Hillsboro, once Wisconsin's largest African-American settlement, as told by the descendants of the original settlers. This is Lake Effect on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio.